KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Ukraine regards any negotiations on Ukraine without Ukraine as one that have no result.
President Zelensky warns Ukrainians won't accept decisions made without them in peace talks.
Today is Monday, February 17th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, we'll hear from our correspondents covering Ukraine, Russia, and France, where President Macron has called an emergency summit.
Also, why has Israel accepted lopsided deals to bring home its citizens?
The issue of the hostages was politicized by Netanyahu and his propaganda machine.
And we need a street sweeper in Mexico City who's become a folk hero and an unlikely pop star.
The stories after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The White House is asking the Supreme Court to intervene on its bid to fire the head of the federal government's Office for Whistleblowers. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports the case sets up a test of the president's executive power.
President Trump moved to fire the head of the Office of Special Counsel Hampton Dellinger earlier this month, but a federal judge blocked the move, at least for now. In the court filing, the Trump administration calls the case an unprecedented assault on the separation of powers. The Trump administration claims the president has the power to remove government officers, and the delay hurts his ability to manage the executive branch. Federal law says the special counsel may be removed by the president only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. None of those concerns were cited in an email dismissing Dellinger. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Delta Airlines says 18 people were hurt after one of its regional jets from Minneapolis coming in for a landing in Toronto ended up on the runway upside down. Officials at Toronto's Pearson Airport say all of the 80 passengers and crew aboard the plane are accounted for. And according to initial reports, there are no fatalities. Deborah Flynn is president and CEO of the Greater Toronto Airports Authority. She praised those involved, saying it could have been much worse.
No airport CEO wants to have these type of press conferences, but this is exactly what our emergency, our operations, and our first responder partners are all practiced and trained for. And again, this outcome is in due part to their heroic work, and I thank them profusely.
It's not yet known what caused the incident. Delta says it canceled its flights to and from the airport for the rest of this evening. After the Eaton fire broke out in Los Angeles, it was not fully contained for more than 3 weeks. NPR's investigations team transcribed hours of first responder radio to better understand how the power company was involved. NPR's Kara Eisner has more.
When high winds and dry conditions whip up a wildfire, power lines can cause problems by sparking or falling down. That's dangerous for first responders and can also start new fires. NPR analyzed almost 100 hours of radio traffic exchanged among firefighters responding to the Eaton fire.
Hey, Delta Branch 3. Hey, I just met with Edison's reps. They're not going to be able to guarantee shutdown in here.
That evidence shows the power company, Southern California Edison, wasn't able to quickly shut off power in two key neighborhoods, and that live power lines led to new fires. The Eaton fire burned down about 10,000 structures and led to the deaths of 17 people. Kiara Eisner, NPR News.
Icy cold weather has continued to hold much of the country in its grip. Harsh weather hit the country's midsection from the Rockies to the Northern Plains. It follows a storm over the weekend that caused flash flooding in parts of the eastern U.S., claiming at least 13 lives there. U.S. financial markets are closed today. This is NPR. When a new government takes over in Germany later this month following a snap election, the economy is likely to be job one. The country has not seen a significant economic growth in 5 years, with business leaders complaining about a shortage of skilled workers, too much bureaucracy, and not enough infrastructure upgrades. Increased competition from China, along with high energy prices from Russia's war against Ukraine, has also hit Germany. The only theater center which produces shows in the Washington, D.C. suburbs has announced an extension of its production of the musical Waitress with a twist. Recently fired federal employees can get a pair of tickets to see the show for free. Jeff London reports.
The upheaval in the federal government in Washington, D.C. has ripple effects outside the workforce. It extends to local businesses, too, and local arts organizations are not immune. Now, the only theater center in Maryland, which opened Sarah Bareilles' Waitress on Sunday, is reaching out to some of its most loyal audience members. The theater says any federal employee or contractor who was recently fired or furloughed can go to the box office with a notice of termination and claim 2 free tickets to the show, subject to availability, an hour before curtain time. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
The Vatican is reporting Pope Francis is suffering from a respiratory infection. The 88-year-old pontiff was taken to the hospital last week. He's expected to remain hospitalized for an undetermined amount of time. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage Service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The Trump administration is holding talks this week with Russia about a possible peace deal with Ukraine. Absent from those talks are the Ukrainians. European nations are absent too, even though as a whole, they give more to keep Ukraine's forces fighting and its government functioning than the U.S. does. That said, European leaders are now actively planning to strengthen their own defenses. This after statements by Vice President J.D. Vance over the weekend, statements that set off alarm bells in Europe over whether the transatlantic relationship is in peril. We are going to hear now from our NPR correspondents covering Ukraine and Russia. We begin in France, where President Emmanuel Macron just called an emergency summit of European leaders to see how the continent can also get a seat at peace talks.
I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris, where European leaders gathered after a disastrous Munich security conference saw them shut out of talks to negotiate an end to the war on their own continent.
The shock is absolutely enormous after the Munich conference.
That's Hans Stark, Franco-German specialist at the Sorbonne University. He says the Europeans must come up with a strategy in the new geopolitical reality where they can no longer count on their American ally as before. He says they must find common positions on strategic issues like
the deployment of European troops in Ukraine, under which conditions, how many, to speed up the building of a European defense industry, how to finance it.
Léopold Audebert, vous êtes sur place, vous êtes tout près du
French TV news channels commented the arrival of 8 key European leaders to the French presidential palace. There was Poland, that knows Kremlin domination well, and Germany with the continent's largest economy. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has already agreed to send troops to Ukraine to secure a ceasefire, though Germany said it's inappropriate to discuss that at this stage. Reporters yelled out as Italy's Giorgia Meloni arrived late. She's a key player, a Trump ally who also supports Ukraine. Everyone here was stunned by President Trump's friendly phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin last week without even notifying his allies in Europe. Macron telephoned Trump to inform him of today's meeting. Europeans congratulated themselves on being the good diplomats. Europe is at a crucial moment as Russia grows more aggressive and the U.S. steps back. There is fear that Trump will give away too much to Putin. European Commission head Ursula von der Leyen summed up the sentiment on social media. Europe's security is at a turning point, she said. Yes, it's about Ukraine, but it's also about us. We need an urgency mindset. We need a surge in defense, and we need both of them now.
I'm NPR's Ukraine correspondent Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. President Volodymyr Zelensky is set to be in Saudi Arabia this week, but not to meet with top diplomats from the U.S. and Russia. Zelensky was in the United Arab Emirates on Monday, and he spoke to reporters in Ukraine via video link. He told them he's in the region for official visits focused on humanitarian and economic issues. He said Ukraine did not know about the Russia-U.S. meeting.
Ukraine regards any negotiations on Ukraine without Ukraine as one that have no result. We cannot recognize any agreements about us without us.
Zelensky is pushing to bring Europe to the negotiating table. He's expected to make his case on Thursday to Keith Kellogg, the retired general President Trump has appointed as a special envoy to Ukraine and Russia. Zelensky says he hopes Kellogg will be in Ukraine for at least 2 or 3 days, and during that time he hopes to take Kellogg to the front line to see the effects of Russia's war on Ukraine firsthand. In Ukraine's capital, the snowy chill captures the mood of this critical moment. Maria Ivanova, a 54-year-old engineer, says people are tired and really want negotiations to start. Meanwhile, Valery Melnikov, a 23-year-old physical therapist, says it's no longer clear how the U.S. actually sees Ukraine. They say bad things today, good things tomorrow, and then maybe the next day they will say something else, he says. We have no choice but to keep listening.
I'm NPR's Russia correspondent Charles Maines. The Kremlin has said the talks will focus on making peace, not war, and announced Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will head the Russian mission to Saudi Arabia. Addressing journalists in Moscow, Lavrov said his job was to listen to the American proposals and report back to the Kremlin. Yet Lavrov also rejected in advance any notion of returning land annexed by Russia back to Ukraine. They say we should probably give territorial concessions. But what for, said Lavrov, so ethnic Russians who live there can be destroyed? His comments come as the latest sign that with Russian forces making gains on the battlefield, Moscow is in little mood to compromise. And U.S. negotiators may find themselves boxed in before the talks even begin by their own president.
We had a great call, and it lasted for a long time.
Following his phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin last week, President Trump said a lasting peace demanded Kyiv end its NATO ambitions and relinquish territory seized by Moscow, two key Russian demands.
In fact, he can accept all demands of Vladimir Putin.
Sergei Markov is a former Kremlin advisor. He says Trump's desire to end the conflict is widely admired by Russians, but so too is Trump's America First agenda, so far as it views continued support for Ukraine as distant to core American security interests.
The only thing which Trump is concerned about is his image. He has image of the strong guy.
Perhaps with that in mind, Putin has extended an invitation for Trump to visit Moscow, leading to speculation Trump could join Putin on Red Square this May when Russia commemorates the end of another war, World War II.
In Mexico, a 23-year-old street sweeper with a golden voice has captured the public imagination. In just 2 weeks, Macario Martinez has racked up millions of views with his rags-to-riches story and has become Mexico's latest pop star. NPR's Eder Peralta reports.
Even before the sun rises, this is what you hear in Mexico City. About 2,000 men and women sweep the streets of this mega city using handmade brooms. And even though they keep this place running, they are mostly invisible and poorly paid. They make $13 a day. But at the end of last month, something magical happened.
Sueña lindo corazón. Sueña lindo.
One of those workers, a 23-year-old with a mop of black hair and a thin mustache, posted a video on TikTok. It was him in his fluorescent green uniform riding on the back of a trash truck just before sunrise. The city, beautiful and gleaming, rushes behind him. And in text, a simple plea. I'm just a street sweeper who wants the world to listen to my music. Sueña lindo corazón. Sueña lindo. Que la herida que dejó. Ya no duela más. The song is also a plea. He's lovelorn, begging his ex for some clarity. The video struck a nerve. It got more than 30 million views on TikTok. How I wish to know the truth, he sings, because as soon as I met you, all I wanted was to make you happy. Suddenly, Macario Martinez was on TV and in newspapers. When he heard his song on the radio, he wept. When a TV station had him on with his mom, he cried on her shoulder. Suddenly, a street sweeper had become a folk hero. I meet Macario Martinez in the middle of Mexico City on one of the same streets he used to clean. Except today, he's about to play a big outdoor concert.
Es como un grito de esperanza.
This whole experience, he says, is a battle cry for hope.
Pues porque todos soñamos siempre con algo.
Because we all dream about something, he says. His dream was for people to listen to his music. When he was on that trash truck, he was thinking about the beauty of the city, about the stories of the people in those buildings, and he was dreaming.
Por ejemplo, no sé, yo veo muchos videos de así antiguos, ¿no?
I used to watch a lot of old videos from my favorite bands in the 2000s, he says, and they toured. They got to leave their cities, some even left their countries.
Pues creo que ahora estoy más cerca que nunca como de cumplir el sueño y...
And right now, he says, I'm closer than ever to reaching my dreams. As we talk, his old cleaning crew shows up in their bright green uniforms, and the crowd begins to build. Alejandro Castillo was front and center.
A los mexicanos nos gusta la telenovela.
We Mexicans love soap operas, and the truth is, he says, we're all Macario.
Todos somos ese personaje que quiere sobresalir y que quiere explotar al mundo en un solo bocado.
We are all that character who wants to excel and take on the whole world with a single bite. And with that, Macario takes the stage, the city towering behind him, the world ready to listen to his music. Peter Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. One big part of President Trump's agenda is something he didn't really mention during the campaign: expanding the U.S. footprint. He's talked about making Canada the 51st state and taking over the Gaza Strip. He says he wants to buy Greenland and reclaim the Panama Canal. Well, earlier this month, I went to Panama covering Secretary of State Marco Rubio's visit there. And my co-host Juana Summers is reporting from Greenland right now. We're going to hear her stories next week. So we're going to take a few minutes to compare notes about what I saw in the tropics and what she is seeing in the Arctic. Hey, Juana.
Hey, Ari.
What is Trump's message about Greenland?
Well, as many people may remember, Trump's desire to own Greenland really dates back to his first presidency. When he's talked about it, he has said that it is an absolute necessity for the U.S. to gain Greenland. Greenland is the world's largest island, and it's an autonomous territory of Denmark. And in recent days, leaders of both Greenland and Denmark have made very clear that this country is not for sale. There's no price tag for it. But what seems to really be different this time compared to 2019, when Trump started talking about this, is the way that Trump has talked about it. He was asked about the situation at a press conference. Let's listen.
Can you assure the world that as you try to get control of these areas, you are not going to use military or economic coercion?
No, I can't assure you. You're talking about Panama and Greenland. No, I can't assure you on either of those two.
And Ari, when he's talking there about military and economic coercion, he wasn't just talking about Greenland. He was also talking about Panama. So I'm so curious to hear from you a bit more about how people on your trip and your reporting were reacting to Trump's rhetoric.
People are definitely anxious about him leaving the door open to military action. Panama has been a strong U.S. ally for decades. But when I visited, I was struck by the amount of nationalism. There were flags everywhere, Panamanian flags lining the highway, flying from buildings, popped into people's front yards. People told me even on Independence Day, they didn't see that many Panamanian flags. And also, because the Secretary of State chose Panama as the first country he would visit after being sworn in, there were protests. People marched and shut down main arterial streets in Panama City. They burned American flags. Here were some of their chants. I mean, they were saying things like, Marco Rubio, get out of Panama, and Panama's not for sale, we will defend it. I talked to this high school art teacher named Marlenis Nunez, who was in one of those demonstrations organized by the teachers union.
El canal es de los panameños y así se va a mantener.
She's saying the canal is ours, and that's how it will remain. She said she was going to defend the canal, and I said, but look, you're a teacher, not a soldier. Here's how she responded.
Nos va a tener que matar a todos. Somos pequeños, pero tenemos un gran corazón.
She said, he's going to have to kill us all. We're small, but we have a huge heart.
Wow.
What's the scene been like where you are? Anyone shutting down the streets with protests?
No streets shut down here. I mean, there are some similar themes, but the reaction has really been more subtle here than I think from what you describe in Panama. But it's also created a lot of anxiety and, frankly, fatigue among people here who I think are frustrated with how many international journalists are coming into the country and asking them questions about what Trump says and may do. We spent an afternoon out in Nuuk, which is the capital of Greenland, and producer Matt Ozug and I were just trying to talk to all these people, and I have to say almost every person said they were not interested in talking to us at all.
Oh, how frustrating.
A little bit, but one man did stop as he was leaving the shopping center that's kind of in the middle of Nuuk. Take a listen. This is Mickey Jacobson. He is a local artist here.
I think it's a ridiculous way to look at other countries that you can purchase it like an item. Maybe Americans should know that we're not an item from a store.
And of course, what we heard from Mickey Jacobson is just one snapshot. So I want to give you a sense of what the public sentiment here has been like. There was a poll that was commissioned recently by a Danish newspaper, and it found that only 6% of Greenlanders would actually support the idea of becoming part of the U.S.
6%. Wow. Small number there.
Yeah, it feels really telling. Ari, I wonder if you can help us understand why President Trump, what's the case he's making when it comes to why he'd want to control the Panama Canal?
The U.S. has a huge economic interest in Panama. Trump has talked a lot about the fees that the U.S. pays to use the canal, but he also talks a lot about Chinese influence. He has falsely claimed that China operates the canal. He has said Chinese soldiers are there. That is not true. In fact, the canal is operated by an independent authority in Panama. There are five different ports, and two of those ports are run, owned, and operated by a Hong Kong-based company. So those have come under a lot of scrutiny. But more broadly, China's influence in Latin America has grown as it has built a lot of infrastructure. Diplomats who we've talked to have said the U.S. has been a little bit checked out of that. And the fact that Rubio chose Latin America as the first place he would visit suggests that the U.S. disengagement from this part of the world is about to change.
Yeah, it's a really telling decision by Marco Rubio.
Juana, let me ask you the same question about Greenland. I know some people have accused Trump of having self-serving interests, like his former national security advisor, John Bolton, who you spoke to. What's the strategic case the administration's making there?
Yeah, so when you listen to Trump talk about Greenland, the argument really does seem to boil down to security. As many know, Russia and China are increasingly active in this region in the Arctic. And Greenland also contains these large deposits of rare earth minerals, which are attractive and incredibly valuable. So I have to tell you about a meeting that we had when we were here in Greenland. We sat down with a guy named Tom Danz. He was appointed to the U.S. Arctic Research Commission during Trump's first term. He is outside of government now, and he told me that he's launched this nonprofit focused on advocating for closer ties between the U.S. and Greenland. I wanted to ask him about this, and this is what he told me.
Greenland is kind of the front door of the United States. It's the first place you pass on the approach, maritime passage to us. So that's something you can't put a price on. I think President Trump comes in and recognizes that our security is at threat today.
And just to put what Danz is saying into some context there, the U.S. has been interested in Greenland for many years and established military bases in this country during World War II. And today, the U.S. military does still run a base called the Patufik Space Base, which specializes in missile defense. And the U.S. could, if it wants to, expand its operations here in Greenland with approvals from both Greenland and Denmark. I talked about the state of this relationship with Akaluk Linga. He's a former member of parliament, and he's also the former president of the Inuit Circumpolar Council.
We are threatened by our best ally, but now it's the most feared country in the world now. And I think that the way that people have changed so much...
After the inauguration?
Yeah, that it has changed the mood completely.
And Ari, you hear him there talking about feeling threatened, being feared, talking about how the U.S. was once seen as Greenland's best ally. That's one of the things we hope to ship away as we continue our reporting here, is the impact that Trump's rhetoric is really having on people's lives, as well as just frankly introducing people to the small territory that finds itself perhaps in an unwanted international spotlight due to rhetoric coming from the United States.
That seems to be so true of both Greenland and Panama. You have these two less powerful countries that always felt, in a sense, protected by their very close ally, the United States, that now feel threatened by this much more powerful force.
That's right. Looking forward to getting to dig into that more.
That's my co-host, Juana Summers, reporting from the capital of Greenland, Nuuk. Look forward to hearing your stories. Thanks.
Thank you, Ari.
This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which reminds you of the power of one human voice. You turn on the radio some morning, or your device, and you're listening to Morning Edition, and you hear one person telling a story from the other side of the world or from a neighborhood near you, and that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. It's been a century since an explorer got stuck in a Kentucky cave and the whole nation was riveted by the race to save him.
This was day 17. They see him and he's gone. He had passed away, they believe, a couple days before that.
Floyd Collins' legacy after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Controversy surrounding New York City Mayor Eric Adams deepened today as four of his top aides and deputy mayors announced their resignations. This comes after the Trump administration's Justice Department moved to drop corruption charges against Adams. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Critics say the DOJ shelved criminal corruption and bribery charges against Mayor Adams, a Democrat, after he agreed to collaborate with President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown. Adams faces growing calls to resign, and now four of Adams' most senior aides say they're leaving office. In a joint statement, three of the officials pointed to the extraordinary events that have rocked Adams' administration in recent weeks. They said, quote, "To stay faithful to the oaths we swore to New Yorkers, we've come to the difficult decision to step down." Speaking over the weekend, Adams rejected calls that he leave office. In a statement sent to NPR, Adams says he's disappointed by the resignations. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
Well, some of the cities that have the most to lose from the Trump administration's plan to cut health research funding include Republican red states that have long supported the president. From the Gulf States newsroom, Stephen Basaha reports. The University of Alabama at Birmingham is one of the top recipients.
Biomedical research basically saved Birmingham's economy after the steel industry collapsed in the 70s and 80s. Economists warned that losing that funding could ripple across Alabama. UAB says life-saving research into things like cancer, Alzheimer's, and heart disease are in jeopardy. A federal judge has temporarily paused those cuts while lawsuits work their way through the courts.
That's Stephen Basaha reporting. Democrats are outraged by the administration's push to gut federal agencies and plan a series of protests outside congressional offices this week. No trading on Wall Street this President's Day, but investors will be getting some updates on the housing market. This is NPR. A program in Chicago is helping reduce arrests for violent crimes among young people in some of the city's neighborhoods most affected by gun violence. NPR's Meg Anderson reports that therapy can be a powerful tool.
The program pairs students with a mentor, and for 6 months, they attend group therapy, where clinicians help them change thought patterns and manage emotions. The University of Chicago Crime Lab found teenagers who took part were nearly 40% less likely to be arrested for a violent crime compared to students who didn't. Researcher Jens Ludwig says the program offers a way to make progress against violent crime without gun control.
If we have 400 million guns in America and they're not going anywhere, anytime soon, then how do we get people to be less willing to use guns against one another?
The difference in arrests held true even 2 years after students finished the program. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
A plane crash at Toronto, Canada's busiest airport today, has ended rather miraculously after a Delta Airlines jet flipped upside down during its landing. Authorities say at least 17 people were injured on the flight from Minneapolis with 80 people on board. Little is known yet about the extent or severity of the injuries. The Toronto airport was experiencing gusty winds with icy conditions on the roadway, or rather runway. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Talks on a second phase of a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas may soon begin. An Israeli delegation traveled to Cairo today to hash out details. To date, there have been six exchanges of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners and detainees under the ceasefire that now ends in less than 2 weeks. Under the first phase of the deal, Hamas agreed to release a total of 33 Israeli hostages. Israel agreed to free around 1,900 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. NPR's Jerome Sokolovsky looked into why Israel repeatedly accepts deals like this. Here's his report.
The wall in Gershon Baskin's office is covered with framed certificates. In the middle, there's a letter from the prime minister.
It says, thank you once again. He never thanked me, but to thank you once again.
Baskin is an Israeli peace activist. In 2011, he used his Palestinian contacts to help the Israeli government free a soldier named Gilad Shalit. Militants from the Palestinian group Hamas had taken him hostage 5 years earlier. The prime minister's letter is dated 8 days after Shalit's release, and it thanks Baskin on behalf of the Israeli government.
Signed, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Benjamin Netanyahu's government at the time agreed to exchange Shalit for 1,027 Palestinian prisoners. One of them was named Yahya Sinwar. He later became the leader of Hamas in Gaza. The October 2023 massacre that he masterminded and the ensuing war with Israel killed around 1,800 Israelis and 47,000 Palestinians. Hamas also took more than 250 hostages.
I wonder if you have any regrets about the Shalit deal?
Look, I have no regrets about the Shalit deal. Shalit was saved if he had been in captivity another month.
His condition would have deteriorated quickly, Baskin believes. Gilad Shalit wasn't the first Israeli exchanged for a large number of prisoners. Soldiers and civilians captured by militant groups in Lebanon have also been freed for hundreds of detainees. And POW exchanges during the Arab-Israeli wars were often similarly lopsided. In the current conflict, Israel has many bargaining chips. There are nearly 10,000 Palestinians in custody in Israel and the West Bank, many held without charge. That's not to say Israel's government wants to do the deals in this way, says Baskin.
Believe me, the Israelis would love to do one for one. They would have no problem doing one for one.
But there are a couple of problems with one for one. It's long been a Palestinian goal to free as many of their prisoners in Israeli jails as possible, and the families of Israeli hostages want them out as fast as possible. In this country, which relies on a people's army, there's a social contract. Sons and daughters are drafted, and if they're captured, the government vows it will bring them back through force or diplomacy. But for many Israelis, this hostage crisis presents a wrenching dilemma. Some are worried the exchanges will incentivize future hostage taking. Some government ministers say fighting Hamas is the priority. And families rallying in the streets for a deal to bring their loved ones home have been smeared as disloyal, says Baskin.
The issue of the hostages was politicized by Netanyahu and his propaganda machine in a way that many Israelis believe that if you make a deal with Hamas, you are supporting Hamas.
Actually, Hamas is almost universally loathed in Israel, but polls show overwhelming support for this deal. For many, it's as much about redeeming the hostages as it is about preserving one of Israel's core values. Rabbi Daniel Hartman flips through a text by the medieval Jewish scholar Maimonides, and he reads a tract.
And there is no greater commandment than redeeming the hostages.
Hartman is president of the Shalom Hartman Institute, which advocates for democracy and pluralism in Israel. Taking Jews captive, he says, has been a problem for more than 2,000 years. It's often been done to convert them out of their faith, and Hartman says also for ransom. It's another reason the ethic of redemption is so strong in Israel.
It's a self-evident truth that we do not leave our people behind.
Human life above all else, a group of protesters chant outside the defense ministry. There have been protests like this one throughout the war, accusing the government of abandoning the hostages. But even those who favor the hostage-for-prisoner swaps say it's been hard to watch people walk free after they've been convicted in Israeli courts of murder. A number of them were serving life terms for shootings and suicide bombings in buses, cafes, restaurants, and other places around the country going back decades. Some Israeli lawmakers want to prevent future swaps by making terrorism subject to capital punishment. It was abolished back in the 1950s for murder convictions. Hartman says it won't work.
There's a fantasy that we should pass a law that we're never going to do this again, or we should have the death penalty. There's fantasies that somehow, you know, and I appreciate them, that we shouldn't be exposed and we shouldn't be vulnerable. But it doesn't matter. You can pass any law you want. At the end of the day, if they have somebody, we're going to pay the price.
Because, he says, though it may seem like a vulnerability, upholding a value like this one is a source of strength.
Hola a todos, y gracias por estar con nosotros en este...
Spanish-speaking journalists join a Zoom call with a Mexican-born Israeli who was held hostage by Hamas. It's not easy for Ilana Grichevsky to remain composed as she recalls the torment she went through at the hands of her captors. They broke my collarbone, destroyed my jaw, burned my leg, and my hip is broken. She says they also told her she would have to marry them and bear their children. But she knew it would end. In November 2023, she and more than 100 other hostages were released in exchange for 240 Palestinian detainees.
Nunca perdí la esperanza.
I never lost hope that they would do everything to bring me back, she says. It's something that, if you lose it, you don't survive.
Pierdes, no sobrevives.
Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
One of the greatest writers to come out of the Harlem Renaissance was Jessie Redmond Fawcett. In addition to her own work, Fawcett nurtured the writing of many others in her role as the literary editor of the Crisis magazine. But her partnership with her boss, the preeminent W.E.B. Du Bois, went well beyond the office. A new novel, Harlem Rhapsody, by Victoria Christopher Murray, looks at how their relationship shaped art and racial politics. Tomorrow, be sure to turn on your radio or ask your smart speaker to play your local station to hear more about the book and one of the most famous Langston Hughes poems Fawcett published. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Trump's efforts to cut federal spending are hitting environmental projects especially hard as his administration works to unwind Biden-era climate policies. Colorado Public Radio's Ishan Thakur visited two projects caught up in the spending freeze.
On a snowy, blustery afternoon, city planner Wade Broadhead is selling me on Pueblo, Colorado.
This is a local historic landmark, and it's been vacant now for about 2 years, and the windows are getting busted out, but it's got a great location right on the...
There's no shortage of boarded-up buildings here on Pueblo's east side, which is separated from the town by a highway and a railroad. But Broadhead doesn't really see that. Like a good planner, he sees potential.
Buildings, they see, oh, that's a good historic preservation tax project, or that's a good brownfields cleanup project.
One brownfields cleanup project is the El Centro Recreation Center, It's an old building, and it likely has lead and asbestos. Pueblo wants to revitalize it into a community hub. To clean it up and other sites in town, the city is counting on a $1 million grant from the federal government.
If we don't get buildings fixed up, eventually they get boarded up, they get burnt down. That's why these funds are so critical for us.
Pueblo formally accepted their grant from the Environmental Protection Agency in January. Then, less than a day later, the city got an email saying their funding was frozen. Broadhead said it felt like whiplash.
Tuesday was just a really confusing day.
And it was a really confusing day for cities across the country. The Trump administration ordered agencies to freeze and review federal funding, especially for climate and infrastructure projects funded under President Biden. Courts have ordered the Trump administration to lift that freeze. But lots of climate-related spending remains frozen. That includes money for the Owista Corporation in Longmont, Colorado.
We are still waiting for payment from the EPA via our payment system.
Crystal Cornelius is Owista's president and CEO. Her organization is expecting $156 million under a grant called Solar for All. They plan to distribute that money to help tribal communities install solar panels and lower energy bills. But when they log onto their government payment portal, Cornelius says their account was gone.
Upon trying to put in our information for payment, we are receiving an error code and that no accounts are found matching the criteria. So
Owista's already spent at least $2 million of their own money. Now, they have no idea when they'll be reimbursed, and they haven't gotten clear communication from the EPA. Owista's been doing this a long time. Their mission is to make sure affordable loans and credit are available to tribal communities to drive economic development. Cornelius has never seen a freeze like this, and she hopes it's only temporary because she says this program is a rare chance for tribal communities to make a dent in their energy bills.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and we've been waiting for once-in-a-lifetime opportunities.
Experts say this funding freeze is largely unprecedented. Martin Lockman is with the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University, and he says the government doesn't usually walk away from contracts it signs with organizations like Owista.
The government of the United States pays its debts. That is a kind of bedrock of the way our economy is built.
The EPA did not directly answer questions about funding for Solar for All grants in Colorado, saying only that the agency had identified inconsistencies in certain grants programs. But Pueblo has heard back from the EPA that their brownfields project is moving forwards, says Wade Broadhead.
We're really optimistic. Pueblo has a bunch of incredible historic sites, but they need a little bit of assistance to get back online.
Owista is hopeful the federal government will ultimately come through for them, too. For NPR News, I'm Ishan Takor in Denver, Colorado.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A federal judge has paused the Trump administration's order to make deep cuts to health research. But that pause is temporary. Stephen Basaha of the Gulf States Newsroom reports on the potential economic fallout that the cuts could cause in Birmingham, Alabama. It's a community that relies in part on that research funding. And a quick note, the University of Alabama at Birmingham oversees the Gulf States Newsroom, but the news and business departments operate independently.
There's this building going up in downtown Birmingham, and it's going to be for biomedical research. And the reason it's getting built can actually be seen on this banner right across the street from it. It says, top 1% for research funding, National Institutes of Health. The University of Alabama at Birmingham gets hundreds of millions of dollars from the NIH. Research that goes into diabetes and strokes and cancer happen in buildings like this one going up right now across the city.
What's happened over the years with billions of dollars in research has literally saved lives.
That's Birmingham Mayor Randall Woodfin. And UAB says the same thing, that these potential cuts to the NIH would slow research into everything, from cancer to Alzheimer's to heart disease. And along with the research, Woodfin worries about Birmingham's economy too if UAB loses funding.
Please remember, this is not just Birmingham's largest employer, this is the state of Alabama's largest employer.
On Monday, a federal judge put a pause on the NIH cuts, which is exactly what Woodfin wants to see.
I'm also waiting for, hoping that our U.S. senators engage and protect Alabamians.
Alabama Senator Katie Britt, a Republican, said in an emailed statement she's all for cutting administrative bloat, but wants to work with the Trump administration to do it in a way that doesn't hinder important research. The NIH said in the memo announcing these cuts that they're necessary because it's paying universities a lot more than private grant providers do for indirect costs like facilities and administration work. Sarah Helmes-McCarty is an economist at Samford University, located in one of Birmingham's suburbs. She says it's difficult to know exactly what these cuts would do to the city and state's economies, but it would definitely mean a loss of jobs.
I have friends who work in the labs at UAB, and they're very concerned. They're like, yeah, I'm dusting off my resume because I don't know what this means for me.
Birmingham's reliance on biomedical research came after the steel industry it was built on collapsed in the 70s and 80s. Last year, UAB received about $330 million from the NIH, according to the agency's website. About a quarter of that covers administrative costs. And the tens of millions of dollars that could be lost here will be felt far beyond UAB's labs.
UAB and the biomedical research that happens there is an essential piece of our economy. And that is something that if it is disrupted, it will greatly impact what we see in our state and in our city. It will affect businesses, restaurants, real estate, all of it.
Trump ran on the promise of both clearing out federal waste and improving the economy. And in this case, these aggressive moves to cut spending could hurt the economy of a state that's consistently voted for Trump. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Basaha in Birmingham, Alabama.
A national park in Kentucky has the longest known cave system in the world. This week, Floyd Collins is being remembered there. He was an explorer whose death a century ago became an international sensation. Reporter Michael Collins, no relation, from WKYU in Bowling Green, reports the tragic way he died led to the creation of Mammoth Cave National Park.
100 years ago this week, one story dominated the headlines, the rescue of Floyd Collins.
Collins had been trapped in a Kentucky cave by a falling boulder, and the whole nation wanted to know from hour to hour what progress his rescuers were making.
That's from a 1950 Times documentary on the most impactful events of the 1920s. Collins lived in Cave City, Kentucky. He was one of many landowners who took part in the cave wars of the early 20th century. They explored the extensive Mammoth Cave system, which had only been partially discovered at the time. Rick Toomey is a geologist and tour guide for the cave system. He tells visitors how Floyd Collins wanted to draw more business from tourists visiting Mammoth Cave.
So Floyd was constantly looking for a cave closer to
the main road to try and find some place that they could get more visitors to come to so they could make a better living.
He soon scoped out Sand Cave on January 30th, 1925, but as another park guide, Jackie Wheat, explains, Collins would never leave.
His foot actually kind of bumps against a loose rock. This rock becomes dislodged and kind of rolls into the passageway right over top of his ankle and foot. And he can't pull his leg beyond this rock.
Collins sat alone in the dark for roughly a day before locals found him trapped. Neighbors and family came quickly to try and free him.
People begin to take turns going in and out, in and out. And this goes on for a couple of days, and they're just not making any progress.
All this action weakened the cave walls, and they collapse. Collins is cut off from the world entirely. The ensuing rescue effort became a national sensation. Congress took hourly breaks to listen to updates over the radio. Thousands came to gawk, pray, and help. Here's the mood described in that 1950s documentary.
The nation felt a genuine sense of frustration and defeat.
Wheat says rescuers continued digging to Collins until they reached him on February 17, 1925.
But this was day 17. They see him, and he's gone. He had passed away, they believe, a couple days before that.
Sand Cave is now shut off completely. Collins' grave next to Mammoth Cave Baptist Church has an inscription that reads, "Greatest Cave Explorer Ever Known." A year after the failed rescue, Congress authorized Mammoth Cave as a national park, in part due to the tragedy of Collins' death. Wheat says we can't ignore the role Floyd Collins played in the park's history.
The national park is also about preserving the stories of the pre-park families that lived here and not forgetting those people, because they played a vital role in what we have today.
To celebrate the 100th anniversary, the park is hosting special tours visiting Collins' homestead, his gravesite, and an overlook of Sand Cave, where he was trapped for 17 days. For NPR News, I'm Michael Collins in Cave City, Kentucky.
In the U.S., men don't live as long as women, on average, and that longevity gap has actually widened in the last couple decades. What doctors have to say about that? Listen for that tomorrow on Morning Edition. And if you aren't by a radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm. On the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to Christopher Miller, author of Chip War, about how tech is helping to shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
You call yourself the Jungle King. You call yourself the Jungle King. You call yourself the Jungle King.
I found out you ain't a doggone thing, said the monkey to the lion on a bright summer day. Say, man, there's a big bad cat living down the way. You know he talks about your folks in a heck of a way, and he says a whole lot of things that I'm sort of afraid to say. Well, the lion jumps salty, all full of rage, like a Harlem cat that's left in his cage.